Hello, you're listening to On The Point, the news collective show formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Caitlin Fung.
And it's Saturday, February the 13th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we are based on UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Today, we're wishing a happy Lunar New Year to all who celebrate it. We'll hear more about it in a special discussion about Lunar New Year traditions in the Vietnamese, Korean, and Cantonese diasporas. We'll listen to some thoughts on how people are trying to keep up with some of these traditions, but also how they can continue to grow in the future.
So, Caitlin, do you mind introducing this piece and telling us what inspired you to hold this discussion?
Yeah, for sure. So Lunar New Year is one of the biggest celebrations of the year for a lot of communities across different cultures. It's often a time for people to gather with their friends, family, and loved ones to share a delicious feast and just generally spend time together. Although we can't do that this year, I was still curious to know more about what people might be up to and how they would usually celebrate it. So I decided to virtually gather some folks to share our thoughts on Lunar New Year. I can only speak to my experiences as a diasporic Cantonese person, so I was really glad to be joined by some folks who were also interested in sharing their experiences as Vietnamese and Korean people. We were also joined by my colleague, Vicky Hui, who helped us moderate our discussion.
Let's have a listen.
Hi, and happy Lunar New Year. So to celebrate this holiday, we thought it would be fun to see how different cultures celebrate it and whether things have changed because of COVID. So my name is Vicky Ho, and I'll be moderating this discussion. And I'm joined today by Caitlin Fung, Carmen Kim, and Amy Do, who will give us some insights from the Chinese, Korean, and Vietnamese ways of celebration. So welcome, guys. Why don't we start with a little self-introduction? Caitlin, do you want to start?
Yeah, for sure. So my name is Caitlin, and I identify as someone from the Cantonese diaspora. So, I mean, you can usually think of that is like a Chinese-Canadian experience usually. But I was born here in Vancouver in Canada, sort of experience generally. And I am currently just a student at UBC. I'm a grad student at UBC in journalism, but that's how I'm coming to this conversation today.
Amy, how about you?
So I'm Amy. I'm from the Vietnamese community and I immigrated about a decade ago. So currently I'm working as an engineer.
Thanks, Amy. And Carmen, would you like to introduce yourself as well?
Sure. Hi, my name is Carmen. I was born in Seoul, South Korea, and I moved to Vancouver when I was 10, so in 2009. So I'm part of the Korean community here, and I'm currently my fourth year at UBC.
Awesome. So thank you guys for coming. And I think we'll start with seeing how we each celebrate. So how do you guys usually celebrate Lunar New Year? Caitlin, would you like to start?
Yeah, I'm, there's so much I could say. I think like with Lunar New Year, I think when a lot of people think of it, they think specifically of like Chinese New Year and they call it like Chinese New Year, which is not accurate because like, you know, more than just Chinese people celebrate Lunar New Year. But I think, you know, most people have the image of like parades in Chinatown and like red lanterns and decorations and putting up sort of different things in your house to encourage good luck and good fortune for the year. They also think a lot about, so there's like lion dancing and other, and like dragon dances and all these other performances as well. But also they think of like the zodiac animals, like the 12-year cycle. I think this upcoming year is the year of the ox. And those are all things that like in my family, we kind of like enjoy as like a spectacle, but when we actually celebrate it, it's mostly just like about gathering as family, sharing a meal together and just like hanging out at like one of our relatives' house and just making and eating food together. So there's kind of like, that's actually what it's like for me, at least as like an actual like Cantonese Chinese person. But there is, I think, this bigger image of it as like this big festival event, which it also is too.
Yeah, I think family might be like a common aspect of a celebration across different cultures. Amy, is that true?
Sorry, I was looking up the difference between an ox and a buffalo because in Vietnamese New Year, the zodiac, we call it buffalo and not ox. So actually our celebration started a week ago. So for us, New Year is about connecting with our ancestors and reconnecting, like family reunion. So in Vietnam, when I was growing up, it was a time for people who had to immigrate to work to go back to their hometowns and spend time with their parents and extended family. So there's this belief that New Year is a very important time to connect with heaven and the people in your ancestry. A week ago, so approximately 2 weeks before the New Year itself, is when there is this god who kind of lives in everyone's kitchen, or actually not god, like a messenger. And 2 weeks before, he would go back up to heaven and report how well your family has been in the last year to the heavenly gods. So it was a really important family dinner. Usually the belief is that we are treating that messenger to a really good feast so that he would say good things about our family and like report good things about us. So that's kind of like a small feast. Then we eat and we pray to our ancestors, kind of letting them eat first, and then we get to enjoy the food after. And then New Year's Eve dinner is very, very important because it's like the last meal of the year, and that's the most extravagant and takes the longest time. Like I remember in Vietnam, it would take like a whole day to kind of plan everything. There's a lot of dishes that we put on the so every household has this like table that usually we light incense, and that's how we pray to our ancestors. So New Year's Eve is about preparing that meal. And then the first day of the year is more to stay home. Although the first person to visit you in the New Year is the most important person. Like they are kind of considered to bring luck for the rest of the year. So if it's someone that you like or someone who has good moral conduct or is dignified, then you are lucky for the rest of the year. So I just remember if someone comes and they figure out they're the first ones, then they would give more lucky money to the kids just to make sure that they're bringing more luck. And then actually celebrations continue for the next weeks, even if people are kind of trickling back to work. There's like a whole spring celebration. So people would go to specific temples or pagodas to pray for good luck and wish for the new year. In Vietnam, the last few times I visited before COVID time, when I could, we would go to this temple, which is known for granting people's wishes, and like just pray and put in our hopes and dreams. So that's generally how we do it.
That's really cool. So it sounds like the Vietnamese culture is more about like the spiritual aspect of a celebration, whereas like in the Chinese culture, we also go to temples, but I think it's more about like, it's less about the ancestors, but more about like just connecting with your immediate family or in your extended family. What about in Korea, Carmen?
Yeah, so it's kind of funny, actually. I could really relate to what Caitlin said about people referring to Lunar New Year as Chinese New Year. So for such a long time, I didn't know that it was the same tradition that I've been celebrating for so many years. And I thought that, like, in Korean, it's called Sarnai. So I just completely didn't make that connection until recently, actually. So in Korea, when I was growing up, whenever it was Harnai, first of all, we would dress up in these traditional Korean clothing, I guess, called hanbok. And it's really beautiful. It has lots of colors, lots of red and blue and green and pink, and like lots of primary colors that really stand out. So all the little kids especially would dress up, and we would go to our grandparents' house. And once we got there, there would be a ton of food. I don't think I can list all the different types of food, but One of the main ones is called tteokguk, which is rice cake soup. So in Korea, they say, like, unless you eat that soup, you don't turn a year older. So you only turn a year older once you've eaten that soup. And then after all the celebrations, you kind of do this ceremony almost where you, like, bow in a certain way to your grandparents and they give you money. So once they give you that money in this pouch, you know, like, your parents say, oh, I'll take care of it for you, but you never know where it goes. So I still don't know where my money is. But yeah, that's kind of all.
Yeah, I think the general impression of, like, the money given during Lunar New Year is that it's given in a red packet. And I was wondering if it's the same for, like, the Vietnamese celebrations and the Korean celebration.
For us, it's also generally red. But in the recent years, I've seen packets that have more modern designs where it's like some art has created a picture of, like, rural Vietnam. So I think that is changing a little bit. But yeah, generally red is still the color for luck.
So we don't have red packets. We have these little round packets that come in different colors, like red or blue or I don't know, whatever color that matches your humbug. So it's not really a red envelope or a packet. It's like a pouch.
Oh, that's really cool. So, like, do you bring the pouch yourself, right? It's not given to you by the elders.
Yeah, you bring it with you. It's like part of your New Year fit. And your grandparents or, like, your relatives just hand you bills and you just pocket it. Or your mom pockets it for me.
I love that so much. Like, you have your New Year's outfit, because I like, we also have like, red is like a very good fortune, lucky color. And, like, in the New Year or, like, the Lunar New Year, for us, we also would, like, are encouraged to wear red, and we're encouraged to wear our, like, Lunar New Year lucky outfit. But yeah, I just really appreciate both of what you had to share, because there's a lot of similarities, I think, like, for me as well. Like, I didn't talk about it as much in the beginning, but, like, we also obviously have like the Lunar New Year red packets of money, or, like, for us, we call it Lysi, and we give it, like, out to, like, children generally, or, like, the elders and ancestors. We also have like, practices where we make sure to respect them, like at, like, a shrine that you usually might have in your house and things like that. So there is a lot of kind of these more spiritual or traditional practices that are part of Lunar New Year. But for me, especially as someone who was, like, born as a, like, overseas as a diasporic person, like, I'm not as in touch with a lot of these, like, more spiritual cultural traditions. So it's really cool hearing about how there's similarities between other cultures and how other people approach it. It makes me curious to, like, do the same with my own.
So for me, when I first immigrated here, I came with my mom and my sister. So my mom was essentially a single mom, and my dad stayed in Korea to provide, like, economic support for us. So after I immigrated here, I was cut off from the family celebrations and traditions that I used to do. So, like, it's most of Korean traditions and holidays for me has been, like, remembering to congratulate my dad or my family in Korea and, like, say, oh, happy Lunar New Year over there. But over here in Canada, I wouldn't be doing anything. So a part of me is kind of sad that I lost that sort of connection to my culture. But also, I think just the nature of my family, we're not the type of family to be doing those celebrations. But I think once I kind of create my own, like, family and friend circles that I share this Korean culture with, I do really want to celebrate things like Lunar New Year, because it's an important part of my identity and almost self-esteem. I think it ties into that as well.
Yeah, I think you have a good point. Like, the diasporic community, like, it depends on where you are, but it's easy to get cut off from the celebrations if you're not around people with the same culture. So it wasn't really a thing when I was in boarding school, because we had Chinese people, but, you know, we follow the school schedule and no one cares about Lunar New Year. So I completely understand how that feels. It's more about, like, you know, thinking about people at home who are celebrating and just connecting with them, I guess.
There is one thing that I want to share more about, like, Korean diaspora and how they kind of how they make an effort intentionally as a community to reconnect to their culture. And I was just reflecting on it during this conversation, and I realized that a lot of the cultural traditions that I lost contact with after I moved here, I sort of maintained connection with it somehow through the church. So I personally don't go to church anymore, but my mom does. And most of the Lunar New Year traditions, you know, like the Sunday of Lunar New Year, the church would buy a bunch of like rice cake called Tsongpyeon from H-Mart, and we would have like a Lunar New Year lunch together. So I thought it was worth noting that, you know, even though a lot of diaspora and especially youth who are immigrants struggle with their cultural identity, there are ways in which, you know, diaspora communities come together to celebrate together. So
I really love that reflection, because I relate to it a lot, especially for me as someone who was like born in Canada, and it's like has a little bit more distance. Like I'm more removed from kind of like my traditions and cultural practices as a result of that. And I think I would totally agree that a lot of how I found my way back to like my Cantonese and Chinese culture is through like connecting with other young people in the diaspora who want to do the same thing as me. And we are just like grasping anything that we can. And one of those things is like Lunar New Year celebrations, because that's one of the more visible things, I think, for us. But I think for us as well, the challenge is trying to dig deeper and connect to it in a way, like on our own terms, because we can connect to it through like I was saying earlier, like those kind of spectacle based like Chinese New Year parades and stuff. But there's like also the deeper level of like honoring your ancestors, or like doing all these other practices to connect with your elders, or to connect with your relatives and family, and what kinds of foods you share or make, etc. Like those kind of deeper level things that I think we're trying to like figure out what it meant to our ancestors or family members before us, but also like trying to create new meaning for what it means to us now as well.
Yeah, exactly. And if I could just like reply to that, I think a lot of the times like immigrants feel like our identity isn't valid, or it's less real or legitimate than, you know, a Korean identity or Chinese identity or Vietnamese identity. But and as a result, I think a lot of young people feel shame and guilt around, you know, how could we let ourselves lose an identity that is very important to us and my family. But I think it's important to, you know, have the occasional reminder that our identity is valid, and that the efforts that we're making to reconnect to our cultures is a beautiful thing. It's not something that we should feel guilty or shameful about. I think in a way it's like falling in love with our ancestry and our heritage. And yeah, I kind of love that.
Yeah, I just want to add, since you guys brought up those points, it reminded me, sometimes when I tell people that I celebrate Lunar New Year, they would respond in something Chinese, or like maybe the only phrase they know in Chinese. And then I'm like, I actually don't know what that means. So I think it's good for us to really represent our culture, so people know that there's more than just one community celebrating that festival or that important day, and we all do it slightly differently, or sometimes very differently. And then on the point of like continuing tradition, I feel guilty, because I am worried that one day when my parents aren't here anymore, me and my sister will probably not be able to continue the traditions that they do, just because, you know, we don't know how to cook the food that they're used to, or we just don't have the habit of preparing for such a long period of celebration. So I guess one day I'll feel pressured to learn and keep up with it. And like I said, even as a kid in Vietnam, I didn't do a lot of those things. Didn't really have to be responsible. So there is kind of this fear in me that I'm losing out. And, you know, I just hope that at least we keep some of the meaning and the memories and try to do as much as we can for our own benefit. Yeah, cooking like a 10-course dinner seems very intimidating.
Yeah, I was just gonna add that like that the fear or like the shame and the guilt around this, I feel like that's so common across like a lot of all of my friends and peers who, whether or not it's like another Cantonese or Chinese person that I'm talking to or anyone else who celebrates Lunar New Year as well, any other cultures, there's a lot of there's a lot of that like afraid shame kind of feeling in the diasporic youth kind of folks that I'm connected with. And I think like that is something that it's bad and it sucks that we feel that, but also like it's part of what brings us together and like motivates us to like want to learn and connect better with these traditions. But I think a lot of us also try to remember to take the pressure off of each other and ourselves by remembering that, like, you know, our relationship to our culture is very personal and is going to be different from other people or from how our parents and ancestors related or connected to their cultures as well. And that's totally okay. I think like it's okay if we aren't exactly replicating like the traditional practice or the exact way that, you know, our parents maybe did, but we can also like kind of create or do things in our own way, and it's still just as meaningful.
Can I throw one more complication or one more layer to this? Also, like when I moved to Canada and growing up into my early 20s here, I started to reflect on how much of the domestic burden falls on women in our culture. So that was a period of time where I kind of reveled. I'm like, I don't want to be, you know, the mother who's like doing all these chores on New Year's Eve. So that was also kind of a motivation for me to stay away from it. But in that process, I also kind of lost that connection and, you know, that pride in taking on that work. So hopefully I can find a man who will help share those chores and like learn with me how to make a proper meal and do the proper rituals.
You know what, Amy? I totally relate with you. I hate the fact that, like, so I guess it goes back to, you know, like Confucian values, but all of Korean traditions and ceremonies, at least most of them that I know of, so many of them center, you know, women working in the kitchen and men just enjoying the food. And even when it comes to, like, it's called Taesa in Korean, where it's kind of like a ritualistic funeral for our ancestors, only the men are allowed to pay honor to their ancestors. So I agree with you that, like, you know, this complication that you added, it's not something that we can just ignore and pretend it doesn't exist. There definitely is this, you know, prominent issue here. But yeah, I'm definitely committed to working to break this through the family that I built. Like, no matter who I meet, I'm going to make sure that he works with me to make all the food.
I really love that. And I think this is like exactly what I was thinking of when I'm, you know, when I was saying that a lot of people kind of maybe our age, like younger diasporic folks, like we want to connect with our traditions, but we want to do it on our own terms or in ways that resonate with us. And one of those things is like leaving behind the parts of it that are harmful or that like no longer serve us. And, you know, this kind of like patriarchal focus is definitely one of them. And for myself as well, I know that there's a lot of like people that I know or like friends that I have who like there's a lot of like queer Asian diasporic folks I know who like maybe they don't have like a good relationship with their family members, to like their biological family members. And, you know, this is a very difficult time for them because Lunar New Year is all about connecting with your family and in that way. But for them, like they can kind of reclaim things like Lunar New Year as a way for them to connect with their friends or their own loved ones and like chosen family members who are not just strictly biologically related, kind of expanding the definition for them of family. So I think that like these are all so important. Like it's so good that I think we're considering and complicating it in these ways, because some of the ways that it was before, like, maybe we don't need it to be that way anymore. Like, it doesn't have to be that way.
Yeah, I think absolutely. Like, I love that we brought this up. And I think, like Caitlin said, it's, you know, these celebrations is personal. You know, it's up to us to celebrate it in the way we feel is appropriate and is comfortable for us. So we just need to keep that in mind. Yeah, thank you so much, guys, for contributing to this. That's been really, really interesting. And we actually learned a lot. And I wish this could go on for longer. Like, there's so much to talk about. But it's really important for, you know, everyone to remember that Lunar New Year is not just, you know, Chinese New Year. A lot of different cultures celebrate it too. And it would be cool to, you know, for us to learn more about these things as we celebrate this year. So thank you, guys, and have a great new year.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded, Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Welcome back to On The Point by CITR 101.9 FM. This is your source for alternative and undercover news from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. And you just heard a discussion from perspectives in the Vietnamese, Korean, and Cantonese diasporas who are celebrating Lunar New Year. Before we get into our discussion, it's also yesterday, technically, was also Lunar New Year for me. So that's Ugadi in Kannada culture. So happy Ugadi to everyone. I would be eating some neem leaves right now to commemorate the bitterness of 1 year passes to the sweetness of the next, but, you know, not doing that. So I'm actually editing. I'm at school to edit something. But anyway, let's talk about something Vancouver politics related before we end the show today. So I'm going off a tweet from Sarah Sagai, you know, a member of the Vancouver Tennis Union. She flagged this to us. Thank you so much. This is from February 10th. So, you know, a few days ago. So basically today, City Council was supposed to, today that is February the 10th, they were supposed to hear from, you know, more than 30 speakers about a motion by, you know, Councillor Jean Swanson about protecting tenants from real estate investment trusts. But just before a long break, the rest of the council voted to cut off the speakers list after only hearing from four. And I want to speak first about the motion and then about what this just signifies for, you know, how council is going generally, right? So the motion was about protecting, tenants from real estate investment trusts. And if you don't know what those are essentially cartels. There's no better way to put this. Those are essentially cartels that own a lot of, they sort of pool their millions and millions of dollars together to, you know, buy up a lot of housing. And then essentially what they do is they set, evictions and all of that by policies. They're very opaque institutions. They're very far removed from the, you know, the traditional mom and pop landlord that we tend to hear about. And they're, I think, I don't know whether they are the predominant source of rent in rental properties here in the Lower Mainland, but, you know, they're certainly the most powerful and the most opaque. And there was a motion by Jean Swanson to essentially remove a lot of their power by, you know, signaling to the feds that, you know, we didn't want these real estate investment funds to get tax breaks, to get financing from, you know, central committees and all of that. But the council voted to cut off discussion just before everyone could speak. And that also speaks to the priorities of this council, because, like, it's pretty wild that, like, in these times of all times, when it's so tough to sign up to speak to counsel about these things, counsel themselves are cutting discussion off, and you know, like you can barely make your voice heard at council when you could go to city council and talk to them. But now when you can't do that, this is just pretty wild. So eventually the motion was passed, but all of the good stuff was taken out of it, like all of the stuff about opposing tax breaks and all of that. It's just very disappointing to hear. And what I'm going to pose a question to both of you, which is, where do you think Vancouver City Council stands? They just, you know, there's 1 year left until the election next year. How do you think this current council has done when it comes to housing? Just an open question.
Yeah, I'd say that they've tried to be very ambitious in a lot of ways. Like, there was a lot of discussion around trying to rezone certain neighborhoods so that it could have more housing that was like triplexes or duplexes. So they were trying to experiment a lot with different types of housing that wasn't just like huge condos and things like that, which was interesting. And we've also seen a lot of like temporary modular housing units also being pushed through, I think, over the last couple of years. And it's interesting because it's like we absolutely need a housing right now. And it also needs to be affordable, but it also needs to be sustainable in the long term. So a lot of these temporary housing efforts, I've seen criticism that it's good right now, but it's just often a band-aid solution when there needs to be more deeper work done.
Yeah, and I think another thing in a different direction is that it's extremely telling, and like Sarah Sagai tweeted about, is that like how the city council has been like inaccessible on that front for people trying to participate and speak. And so that's another half of the problem of like local politics, I suppose.
Yeah, I remember that like over the past couple of years where there was a lot of development hearings sort of happening in Chinatown specifically, a lot of people were very interested in speaking on the list for that at city council meetings. But those meetings were extremely inaccessible. One of the big sort of glaring oversights that they had during those meetings was the lack of interpretation services. Like, there was no interpreters for all the different sort of languages that people were coming to that meeting from. And especially in a neighborhood like Chinatown, like, you should have language accessibility.
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty wild. And as I've talked about this before, but the inaccessible nature of council proceedings and, you know, government proceedings more generally, it's intentional. It's not, in as much as we can work within the sort of liberal democratic model that we have, the sort of inaccessibility is intentional. It's not inevitable. Like, it really is not. Like, it's just about a question of priorities. If council really cared about hearing from people, well, first of all, it wouldn't be, I think, constituted in this particular way. Like, I think the fact that there are 10 white members of council for such a diverse city tells you a lot. But, you know, it just wouldn't be this opaque. These dealings would not be this way. So, yeah, it's just disappointing overall. And, you know, yeah, I think to my question about the housing problem, it's a weird one, right? Because 1 year ahead of the election, there's been a little bit of progress, as Caitlin put it, but I don't know. It's not certainly on the scale that we need, considering how many homeless people experiencing homelessness and everything else that we have, like the opioid crisis and all of that. Like, it's a mixed bag. Let's just put it that way. It's a bit of a cop-out answer, but we'll have to see if there are more radical solutions ahead of next year's election. And you know, on the topic of politics, actually, let's touch on the overdose crisis again. You know, a few days ago, really unfortunately, you know, it turned out that it's not really too much of a surprise here, but, you know, 1,716 people lost their lives due to poison drug supply. You know, by far the worst year on record. So, you know, like, I think so that translates to around what I'm trying to think. Is that how many people per day is that? Around 300 or so? A little more. That's, I think, more than some years total per day. So that's just wild. And the, you know, the provincial government has written to the federal government asking for permission to decriminalize. But the thing is, they could have already passed laws to decriminalize it using a made in BC solution. So that doesn't really tell you too much about the priorities. And yeah, it's just heartbreaking. It really is.
I think having these simultaneous health crises going on has not helped. Really, it's really quite exacerbated everything, as has been said many times. And part of that is also the way that it's been framed, I think, in sort of some public health messaging and some just like mainstream sort of media discussions about it. Like, the same level of urgency that has been given to the COVID-19 pandemic has never been given to kind of this crisis also of overdoses and drug policy. And I was actually reading the other day that, you know, framing it as an opioid crisis is also a little bit misleading, maybe, because this is really about a policy crisis, because it's like government drug policy that has allowed so many lives to be lost.
Absolutely. It's and like, I don't need to go into how the fact that we even criminalize drugs at all is just a huge reflection of racist policies, plain and simple racist, sexist policies. It's just very, very silly. And, you know, the fact that apparently the province wrote the letter to the feds, Justin Trudeau has never said that he'll decriminalize possession of drugs. So, I mean, that's probably not going to do anything. It's just a sort of symbolic thing by the NDP government to sort of say, hey, we're doing something, even though they're not. So, you know, it's all good. It's all great. I don't know. As I talk about a lot when it comes to these sorts of things, I don't know when the tipping point is when everyone starts to see that this is very unjust. But yeah, you know, you can't really say too much about that, can you? But yeah, that's really all I had when it came to discussion. Is there anything else you'd like to add? Any of you? All right, I guess we'll end the show there. Again, a very happy Lunar New Year to everyone who celebrates it. And hopefully this year is better for everyone, as much as that means. So yeah, I think Isa, you can take us out.
Yeah, so we'll be back next Saturday at 7 p.m. for more local news. Stay tuned for more great, amazing CITR programming. Oh,
If you're gonna keep crying, baby, till it's all you've got left, remember me to your dolls with a joke. I think that'd be best. 'Cause I didn't have to do this bit like a dog. I slept mine off in a hollow log, only to wake up to your bleeding, hanging like smog. Oh, don't remember me through your teardrops looking wet, 'cause I shake the drops off my cap. It's simply springtime in the great Northwest. Down at the end, if you don't find your friends in the Gulf, if you don't find your flag, well, I'll still have myself. Somewhere downstream of this bad dream, I'll swim ashore when I recognize my old world as it was before a sun had just dived in. But don't tread on my toes. Kick and swim. Keep the muddy water out your nose. You almost had your chance today, despite your weak mind and your shoreline crumbling away. Had your chance to feel different.
Camao con la Hola, 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 everybody. This is DJ Bruja from your favorite show, Viva Poru, the ointment for the soul. This week is Fun Drive here at CITR, the one time each year where we ask for your support to help us keep local, independent, and alternative voices on the air. For me, CITR is my favorite creative refuge, a place that has given me the opportunity to share what I love most about my culture and to bring some magnificent Latin tunes to life here in the unceded, ancestral, and traditional Musqueam territory. If you are in a position to contribute, please visit citr.ca/donate. Thank you and happy Fun Drive!
Always live my life in your hands. Nothing to you, I know I shouldn't. I've always lived my life in between what you wanted and my dignity. Held me down so long, I can't get up. Now I see something's wrong. You interrupt. All you ever do is tell me, tell me, tell me I'm supposed to be. Did you ever really love me, love me? When I was only being me. Hey, to say, I don't know. Should I stay or should I go? All you ever do is try not to see that all you ever do is tell me. Off all of the dirt, the scumbags and my self-worth, just to morph into your perfect frame, knowing I will never be the same. Call me beautiful, through others' voices, make me the one of fault for your damn choices. All you ever do is tell me, tell me, tell me I'm supposed to be. Did you ever really love me, love me, when I was only being me? Hate to say, I don't. Should I stay or should I go? All I ever do is try not to see that all you ever do is tell me. To be, did you ever really love me? Love me when I was only being me.
Make a note to tune in to Code Blue on Saturday, February 6th from 3 to 5 with your hosts Jim Burnett and Paul Norton. They'll be battling it out to impress each other and hopefully you as well with their favorite classic Mardi Gras and New Orleans numbers. Since you can't exactly head down to the Big Easy to experience the real deal this year, this is your next best bet. The whole idea is to entice you to make a donation to CITR for the 2021 Fund Drive. If you're suitably impressed, head on over to CITR.ca/donate and plunk down a bit of cash to help the station keep on keeping on. And don't forget to pick Code Blue as the inspiration for your donation. Thank you.
Hey there, this is Dan from The Shakespeare Show. This week is Fund Drive here at CITR, the one time each year where we ask for your support to help us keep local, independent, and alternative voices on the air. For me, CITR is important because we get to play all sorts of genres and eras of music, and and we get to say just about anything other than stuff that's discriminative or might put any or might put somebody in danger or whatever. But anyways, and this has changed my life because, you know, well, I never thought I would be doing something like this. I mean, I'm just glad I get to do it right now during an epidemic from home. I've been doing this for nearly 8 years. And if you are in a position to contribute, please visit CITR.ca/donate to donate. Thank you so much.
Cause they say my bass is never ending. We count pennies, then it's clever spending. I reap the benefits from banging out beats, then it's back to letter bending. And they want influence but lack perspective. You know my giants have been quietly building, just check the track record. You fucking with the masterclass professor. Pick a discipline, kid.
intimate. Chisel tips, instruments, and yeah, I used to never take initiative. But things change, now I'm like, is the wizard quick screaming, this is it. Precision hits for Rhythm Nation, Citizen Smiths. Mouths watering and fingers lick, while Vish local can watch and flash in the pan. Kids fizzle quick, I'm asking myself when will we get it in. But for now, I'm content just saying my prayers on the drum. Asking for sustenance off the labors of my love. Something that means something, not that flavor of the month. It's like you're gonna go my way, but yo, I'm always on the run. And I'm done, like Lenny Kravitz's bastard son. She's like, you're gonna go my way, but girl, I'm always on the run. We building peace by peace, yo, we rocking these beats by recipe. Be my hands and feet, we don't fold, you know, we don't crease while we rockin' it. Yeah, rockin' it, rock, rock.